response.
Is your business struggling to be seen, not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, line starts here.
The debate over New York's new bail reform law continues to rage. Critics rail that it has allowed dangerous criminals free to commit new crimes because it has eliminated cash bail for most low-level offenses and nonviolent felonies and robberies. But while that story plays out, this week on 880 In-Depth, we'll look at the next front on the criminal justice reform plate in New York, parole reform, and how it will likely be just as controversial. I'm Tim Scheld, and we're about to spend some time with the architect of New York State's proposed parole reform, Bronx State Senator Gustavo Rivera. His passion for criminal justice reform and fairness in the system will jump right through the microphone at you. We sat down with the Democratic State Senator for an in-depth view of parole in New York State.
Parole is not supposed to be about further punishment of people. It is supposed to be about assessing whether someone is ready to return to society. I have been talking about issues of parole fairness for a long time.
And we think that it's gaining some steam because of the makeup in the state legislature has allowed for it to come to fore.
Certainly.
To a certain degree.
I mean, I remember even back in 2017 when we were still in the minority, meaning the Democratic Conference, which I currently belong to, and I've always been a member of. We were not in the majority for a long time, but now that we are in the majority, we are talking about it more. But I remember back in 2017, where there were some changes to the parole board when new people were assigned and a couple of people who had been members of the parole board for a long time, but who saw themselves, and you could tell by the way that they expressed themselves in parole board, the way that they wrote the decisions, the way that they interacted with people who were inside, they saw their role as, I'm looking at you as somebody who's been incarcerated, you will remain incarcerated.
Some of those meetings took minutes, right? Did I read?
Some of them took minutes. A few years ago, I traveled up to the Fishkill Correctional Facility to be able to sit for a whole day. I sat in a parole board room where two parole board members, because the board, one of the things is that you have to have at least two people, but if you have two people as parole board members and one of them says yes, one of them says no, then the person stays inside, right? But you have, for a long time during Governor Cuomo's reign, there has been not enough people appointed to the parole board. So right now there's only 12 members when statutorily you could have up to 19. So when you have prisons all over the state that are doing parole boards, you have people who have to travel 5, 6, 7 hours to be able to just get there before some of these boards, you only have two people on them. So I traveled to Fishkill and sat for a whole day and sat in a whole bunch of parole board meetings just to see what the hearings were like, to be able to just sat quietly in the back, asked no questions, just listened. And while I certainly recognize that my presence there probably changed what actually occurred, it did give me a sense of the type of, you know, how difficult the job this is for parole board commissioners, and I don't deny that, but how much we have to rethink this entire process. It should not be about further punishing someone. That has already been done by a judge and jury, by the process that they went to at the beginning of their experience in the criminal justice system. Now that they're at the end, the process should be different. It is about assessing, have you learned from your mistakes? Have you accepted responsibility? Can you become a productive member of society? Are you a danger if you go back to it? And if the answer to any of that is, yes, you've learned from your mistakes. Yes, you've changed as a person. You have a place to go and live and work, and you are not going to recidivate. You're not going to come back here. Then you know what? We should let you out.
This plan is something called the Fair and Timely Parole Act. Parole, in case you didn't know, is the early release of a prisoner who has served a significant amount of their sentence. Release is on the promise of living under certain conditions, including not committing any more crimes and regularly checking in with the system.
So the main thing that happens now, the way that the law is written, it basically allows a parole board commissioner to just rely strictly on what they call the instant offense. That refers to the crime that was originally committed. So whether that crime was committed a year ago or 20 years ago, and more importantly, currently, regardless of what the individual has done in the time that they have been inside the system, they're just basically, you know, the way that the law is currently written, it says that if I as a parole board commissioner were to let you out, then that would be disrespectful to the law. There's a particular phrase that right now escapes me, but the way the current law is written, you basically, me letting you out as a person who is currently incarcerated, if I let you out, then that would be a disrespect to the law. And so the problem with this is that it conceives of the system strictly as a punitive one, which is ironic when we call these facilities correctional facilities. We're supposed to say, you know, the reason why the Fair and Timely Parole Act is necessary is because, first of all, I believe in redemption. I believe that you as an individual should not be judged by the worst thing that you have ever done. You can change. And if someone has demonstrated that they can change, now I'm not saying that there are not knuckleheads out there or inside prison who are never going to accept responsibility, who are never going to move on, and who are going to be a danger to society, but that is exceedingly rare. And we should not build a criminal justice system based on those cases. We should say that if you have done your time, if you have accepted responsibility for your crime, if you have done everything that we allow you to do inside prison to educate yourself, you demonstrated that you can be a better individual, that you have accepted responsibility, then hey, let's allow you to come outside. The way that the law is currently written as far as the responsibility of those individuals who are parole board commissioners is that they just should not assess strictly the instant offense, the thing that they originally did, whatever the person is in prison for. That certainly could be part of the consideration. But the problem is that the way the law is currently written, those individuals who don't necessarily want to let people out, and there are many of them, who just view someone who's in prison and as if they should remain there for the rest of their lives, and they act like it. When you read some of these transcripts, there was a guy named Smith. I forget his first name, but he is a dude who served in the parole board for like 20 years, and the governor put him up, and then he didn't actually, you know, I questioned him. This is back in 2017, and I just questioned him at length about what he had said on the record to some of the individuals that he was supposed to be considering.
Is this at a hearing?
Yeah, it was a public hearing. So there was a hearing in the Crime Victims, Crimes and Corrections Committee back in 2017, which is still, it's publicly available, not the best video quality, but, you know, we're getting better in the Senate in that regard. But there was a whole conversation that I had with him, and I said, I'm going to read you some of the transcript of the interactions that you've had with people. Why would you feel that this is professional? Why would you refer to someone this way? It's as if though he was saying with his disdain in his interaction with this person who was incarcerated, it's like, I don't care what you've done since you committed this crime. As far as I'm concerned, you did this whatever 15, 20, 30 years ago. That's it. You're done. You're never going to leave here. And the fact that there were people who were sitting in the parole board, and even there's a couple now, less, but there's a couple now, because of the way the law is currently written, they can do that, and they're within their right.
So if there's a dozen people on the parole board, it really can be the luck of the draw. You could get a real hard ass, excuse the expression, or you could get someone that may be feeling the way that your reform is going in that direction.
Yeah. As a Bronxite, I've never heard such language, so please refrain from using such language. But in all seriousness, that's one issue, that you don't know who you're going to get. So it might be one of these individuals that, again, just says, you know, if you're in here, you should remain in here. But also the other issue, as I mentioned earlier, is because you have so few, there's currently 12, we could have up to 19. So there's 7 slots that remain unfilled. So now you have to have a parole board. You might need 3 people. which is preferable because you have an even number. If one says yes, one says no, then the person's staying inside. But if you have three, you can at least have an opportunity for an individual to say, you know, you've convinced two of them that you can go back to society, and one of them no, but 2-1 means you go out. But you don't have that. So you have an ability. And by the way, the amount of information that has to be processed by each one of these parole board commissioners. And I say, it's not an easy job.
Right.
I've seen the, I'm making a sign with my hands here, but we're looking at like a 6 or 7 inch stack of papers. I've seen it in front of them related to one case, which can be all of the documents related to the original crime that they committed, the things that they've done as far as educational programs and what have you while they've been inside, letters in support or in opposition to their release, etc. And they have a limited amount of time to take in all of this information. And then they have like 5, 10, sometimes 20 minutes with somebody who's incarcerated, and they have to make a determination. So it's a tough job for them. We should lessen the amount of work that they have by putting more parole board commissioners on there. And we should, you know, kind of change some of the parameters so that it is an easier job for them, so that they can see more people. Because ultimately, I believe that if people are inside, but they've paid their dues, they've done their time, then they should come home.
These cases can become politically toxic, as you know.
There's no doubt.
A lot of the opposition has been, and you don't want to put it on a party, but it can be some of the Republican senators over the years.
And some of my Democratic colleagues, too. Mm-hmm. That is correct.
And obviously members of the police union, the PBAs and such. You know, one of the cases that I think you cite as an inspiration to parole reform is Mr. Fareed. Is that?
That is correct.
Tell me a little bit about that example of, you know, a case that could have been politically toxic. Wasn't it an attempted murder of a police officer,
yes,
among other
things? Let's start with some basics. If you believe as an individual that there are some things that if somebody does some things that they should not be forgiven for them, then I have nothing for you. Then whatever else I say will fall on deaf ears. And, you know, that's you have certainly a right to feel that way. I do not believe that that is the case. As I stated earlier, I do not believe that any human being should be defined by the worst thing that they did. So in the case of Mr. Fareed, he was convicted of an attempted murder of a police officer. Now, that is a serious offense. And now, an attempted murder for anybody is a serious offense. But of a police officer, obviously, it takes a particular level, you know, of person to actually do that. And the thing is, Mr. Fareed was convicted of that. He served time. He accepted that he did that. He acknowledged that he did that. He asked for forgiveness for doing that. And on top of that, then started to make himself better. He educated himself inside, behind bars. He became an interpreter for people hard of hearing. He learned sign language, etc., to be able to be helpful to folks who are hard of hearing or deaf. The point is that Mr. Fareed was an example of people who have tried to make their lives better, who have committed to recognizing the mistakes that they have made, and they've tried to become better people. So it can become politically fraught, and I get that. My response to them, to anybody who has a problem with it, is I would tell them, like I just said, you might not be in agreement with me because you might think that there are things that people can never be forgiven for. So if that's the case, I got nothing for you. But in most instances, if an individual has committed a crime but has actually changed their ways, has become a better person, has strived to be a better person, has tried to make other people better while they're inside. And the examples are there. I've had so many opportunities to work with formerly incarcerated people who are now back outside, have become part of different advocacy organizations, have become active parts of their community, and have become valuable members of it. Why are we stopping those individuals from doing that just because of something that they did, which again, they've accepted responsibility for, and they've paid their dues about? I believe that we as a society have to start asking ourselves tough questions about, we are asking ourselves very tough questions about the criminal justice system.
This is a morality question, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's not just reform. It's how do we feel from a moral point of view?
How do we feel from a moral point of view? Because this is what I'm saying. We have to start with very basics. How do we view our societies What is our society's view on punishment? What is our society's view on crime? If we, there are some individuals who believe that criminal activity is something that is, I don't know, innate in someone, that might be, you know, something that's in their genes, you know, genetic and what have you, and driven by something that's far, you know, deeper and dark, etc. And we've seen enough movies with serial killers to convince us that there's one around every corner. That's not the reality. Crime is a much more complicated matter. We have been discussions currently, for example, in this whole discussion about bail reform, about how for many, many generations, poverty has been criminalized. When you think about the fact that, you know, certainly innocent until proven guilty, but just a few blocks from where we are right now, Harvey Weinstein is waiting for a judgment to come down. Now, this is somebody who allegedly has been a serial predator of dozens and dozens of women. He's destroyed women's lives left and right. But since he's a millionaire, he got to go home and chill in his million-dollar pad while he waited for this whole process to just, you know, do itself, you know, carry itself out. And Khalif Browder, who was a constituent of mine, a young man who was 16, was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack, spent 3 years at Rikers Island because he refused to say that he was guilty of something he had never done. Ultimately, the charges were dropped. He spent two of those years in solitary confinement because he couldn't afford bail. He ultimately committed suicide because of the PTSD that was a result of all the stuff that he suffered inside. So we have to deal with our vision of what is punishment, what is crime, how we approach it.
Senator Rivera is not without his critics, and he knows it. Police chiefs, police unions, victims groups, many in his own legislature. They question the wisdom of these proposed changes.
And by the way, let me be very clear about this. I'm not saying that there should be anarchy in the streets.
Right, you're not soft on crime, I was going to say.
Yeah, this is not about,
this is not about being soft on crime.
This is about being smarter on crime. This is about thinking about, you know, why does a 17-year-old commit robbery? If we have a 17 or an 18-year-old that commits robbery, should we not figure out why that kid had no other options that they saw for themselves? If you believe that there is something genetic that they just have to go and stick up somebody, then, you know, then it is what it is. But I think it's more complicated than that. If there's an 18-year-old in my neighborhood who's a black and brown kid who has, you know, stressful family life, who doesn't really have see job opportunities or education opportunities, and he needs money and what have you, and try to maybe sell drugs to try to provide for his family. Like there's, it's a little bit more complicated. So we have to think about what type of investments we make in our system to make sure that things like that don't happen. And then as I'm dealing with parole, we've already done so much. The way that we've organized ourselves for so long has had such impacts, then we need to think about how we deal those and how we dial some of that back. And so for individuals who are currently incarcerated, who have served their time, and I repeat, once again, have committed mistakes, have done things that are wrong, but they've accepted it, they've acknowledged it, they've done everything that they could to make themselves and other people better, then we should give them an opportunity to come back to society.
Could there be, and is there discussion about cop killers or, you know, exceptions to this or making different rules? Does that help you with the PBA or police chiefs or anything like that?
I'm not going to say that that's not difficult because there have been, I actually spoke on the floor of the Senate about one such case of someone who was denied for parole 10 times. So he spent like an extra 20 years inside after he'd already spent 15 or 18. And he ultimately committed suicide inside prison. Excuse me. And it was somebody that actually killed a police officer. So I'm not denying that those are things that are bad. And I'm not saying that those individuals shouldn't be held responsible. The question that we have to ask ourselves is how do we actually hold those people responsible? And is it worth it as a society to keep someone inside indefinitely, forever? Basically just shut them off from society,
yeah.
Warehouse them. Does it make sense? Now, for some people it might. I don't think it so. I don't think it's so. I think it has to be judged on an individual basis. And I think that there are folks who have committed heinous crimes who can, again, should not be defined by the worst thing that they ever did. And that obviously doesn't get me many fans in certain circles, but it is what experience has taught me.
I mean, there might be people who say that Harvey Weinstein, if convicted, should never see the light of day. And at his age, he may not. But just because the heinous aspect and the things that, if you believe them, that he did in terms of using his money to silence witnesses, to push his influence in different ways, to push his influence within the district attorney's office, if you believe some of it.
Without a doubt. See, the question is, do we believe that justice should be vengeance? And in the case of Harvey Weinstein, as an example, he absolutely needs to be held accountable for his crimes, alleged crimes. But I don't know, while we're sitting here recording, the verdict might have come out. But once it does...
I would know. They'd be jumping around, pointing at me.
Exactly.
We're in the middle of the newsroom.
They'd get like, get out! Yeah. We need to go live. So, but whenever this person, let's say that he is indeed found guilty, and I think every indication, even though I have not been sitting in the courtroom every day, every indication is that there's plenty of evidence that this is a predator that needs to be held accountable. That person does need to go to jail. But does he need to go to jail forever? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe he will not be repentant. But let's say that he actually does have a change of heart, that he spends 5-10 years inside, and he makes a determination that he accepts what he has done, that he tries to make amends, that he actively seeks out individuals who he has harmed and reaches out to them and says, I know that I've harmed you, and I know that I can't change that, but I can at least try to both apologize and try to make it up to you by being a better person. That might happen. I don't know. We have to be consistent on this. Is our justice system supposed to be just a tool of vengeance? Because if it's a tool of vengeance, then again, it's, we're living in, in the 1980s during, during Rambo times or what have you. And I think that we need to strive for better. So again, everyone should be held accountable for the things that they do. I'm a big believer in accountability. It's the reason why I'm in the Senate. The guy who was there before me needed to be held accountable. He then spent 6 years in federal prison for stealing public money. He served his time. He's back home now. I'm hoping that he used that time to recognize that his actions disrespected the community that he was supposed to represent. So he's paid his dues. I would say that the same is true for anybody else. And for us as a society, do we believe that a justice system should strictly be about vengeance and punishment, or should we think beyond that?
And for those who may not know about parole, it's not like they open the door and say goodbye.
Correct.
There is monitoring. There will be accountability if there are crimes committed. You'll be thrown back in.
And first, there's a process. Even with the changes that I proceed that I propose in this bill, the changes would still allow and give the authority to the parole board to make the assessment of whether this person is a threat to society. Because that is what the parole board's job is supposed to be. It's to assess. Now, you have been found guilty of whatever crime. You've served your time. Now that your time is done, can you go back to society? Our job is to assess whether you would be a danger if you go back. And in most instances, regardless of what that person does during their stay inside, because of what they did to get there, then they're judged and said, well, you need to stay inside forever again. Now, that's not the way it should work.
And it's not so easy, because even if you look at bail reform, there are examples of folks that were let out, and obviously the opponents to the reform are quick to raise up all of those examples of someone that was let out and committed a crime. It's never going to be a perfect system.
Never. But then those same individuals that are criticizing, to talk about bail reform for a second, they're neglecting to mention the thousands of people who have been able to go back home at the end of the day after they've been arrested for whatever crime that they are not guilty of. Being arrested doesn't mean you're guilty of anything. It means you're going to be accused potentially of something. Even at that point, like I described Khalif Browder earlier, he was arrested. He was charged. Those charges were ultimately dropped. He wasn't even prosecuted for supposedly stealing this backpack. So there are currently thousands of people who have been able to go back home at the end of the day, have not lost their job, have not lost access to their kids, have been able to stay in their homes or stay in the shelters that they live in, et cetera, et cetera. Those cases are not talked about. What is happening right now is a lot of fear-mongering, a lot of lies trying to confuse the larger point. The system that we had been using forever and that in many instances still exists is one that criminalizes poverty, does so in a racialized way, and has done so for generations. This thing that we're having right now, the bill that we've passed and the laws that are in effect, it's been a few months, literally a few months, as opposed to a few generations of a bail system that criminalized poverty. So guess what? I'm gonna wait this out. I need more information. I will not bow to criticism that is based strictly on lies and fear. If you're telling me page 7, line 5 of this bill does X, and therefore I can't really be with you on that one, then that's a legitimate concern. And let's talk about page 5, line 7, subsection B. Let's talk about that. That's not what's happening right now. What's happening right now is like there are people that are, you know, there's the stories are like this person is on the streets, this person is that. In many instances, by the way, misinformation has been put out there and then people run with it. Again, as opposed to talking about the thousands of people whose lives have been changed in the positive because they've been able to not get stuck inside the criminal justice system like they had been if it was December 31st, 2019 or before that. So guess what? I'm going to wait this out. I'm going to see what is actually occurring before I go forward with any type of changes.
So to try and bring it full circle in terms of the Fair and Timely Parole Act, if you get a chance to get this voted on this year, is the best way to describe it that currently the system does not really give parole board members, does not encourage them to consider what has occurred since the crime has occurred? And what you're trying to do is at least add that to the equation as part of this deal, as opposed to allowing someone to completely discount what has happened since the crime has occurred.
That is exactly right. Well, what we're trying to do with this bill is to give explicitly say to parole board members, you must consider in a real way and weigh it in a real way who these people are today, not who they were the day that they committed whatever crime they're in here for. And that's ultimately what we're saying. They still have the authority to say, we believe that you will present a danger to society if you go back out. I mean, listen, what's his name with the freaking swastika on his
Manson.
On his forehead? Manson. All right. Manson probably needs to remain inside for a while. You know, I don't know if he's passed
dead.
Away.
Yeah.
He's passed away.
Yeah. It's one of those dead or alive kind of things you can win in a bar.
Exactly.
Dead.
Thank you. For the rest of, I will keep that in my head. The point was, during his incarceration, he did not demonstrate that he had changed. He demonstrated that he was still not very right in the head and that he would very likely commit some other heinous crimes if he was let outside. But that's one dude.
Right.
Those are exceedingly rare cases. We're not talking about those folks. The role of the parole board is to assess whether someone is a danger to society. And what my bill would do is change the law to make sure that they take into account in a real way and weigh in a real way who the people that they're looking at, who they are today, not who they were the day that they committed whatever crime they're inside for.
I'm guessing that the stickiest part of this for you has been and will be cop killers or people involved in crime, because the PBA is a pretty strong, political, not political, I give money to political, but people do want to find ways to support cops because they put their lives on the line for us. And so, you know, I guess my final question is, what do you say? What do you say when you're in the room with PBA people or police chiefs or law enforcement folks that challenge you on that topic?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that the overwhelming majority of the people that this would be impacting have nothing to do with those types of crimes. So I would say, let's acknowledge that the resistance that you have might be for a particular class, and we'll talk about that in a second, but that the overwhelming majority of people who would be positively impacted by this are people who are not accused of anything that heinous. That's number one. And number two, I would say to them that we probably have a difference of opinion on whether somebody can, you know, can redeem themselves. There's individuals that might be listening to this eventually or who are police officers or families of police officers that believe that such a thing should not be forgiven. And I will understand and respect that. But I believe, again, that if we're going to have as a society a conversation amongst ourselves about what our justice system is supposed to be, then I believe that in the conditions that I have outlined, if someone has assessed responsibility, has accepted responsibility, has tried to seek forgiveness for that act, and has done everything in their power to try to become a better person, then they should be given an opportunity to come back out. And for those folks who do not agree with me because they believe that there are some actions which are not forgivable and that they should remain inside forever or worse, then we're just going to have to respectfully disagree.
As 2019 ended, it appeared that this idea of parole reform was gaining steam in New York and might actually have some promise this year. But the renewed debate over the new bail reform law and how it's worked out could hurt the chances of the legislature's stomach for any additional reform. Still, Senator Rivera tells me that none of this stuff is easy, and he remains committed and believes in reform so much that he will promise to keep up the fight. You've been listening to 880 In Depth, our weekly deep dive on a topic of importance in our community. If you like the podcast, we encourage you to subscribe, listen to it every week, and tell a friend. I'm Tim Schell.
I'm Anna Garcia, host of True Crime News, the podcast. Every week, we bring you in-depth coverage on cases making headlines, as well as those that go under the radar. Tune in for murders that defy explanation, mystery seeking exploration, and shocking secrets that will leave you breathless. Each week, we honor the victims by going beyond the salacious in our search for justice. Crime never stops. And neither do we. Listen to True Crime News, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.